The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Martin McDonagh was a playwright in his 20s when he burst onto the theater scene in London. At one point, he had four plays running simultaneously on stages across London. But McDonagh also aspired to work in movies, and he eventually made In Bruges, a real favorite of mine, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. McDonagh's newest is called The Banshees of Inisherin. Although most of McDonagh's plays were set in Ireland, this is his first feature film about the country. It traces the story of a friendship breaking apart, and it's set in the beautiful, remote hills of a fictional island west of Ireland. The movie stars Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson.
Now, I'm sitting here next to you, and if you're going back inside, I'm following you inside, and if you're going home, I'm following you there too.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you. And if I've said something to you, maybe I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it, but I don't think I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it. But if I did, then tell me what it was, and I'll say sorry for that too, Colin. With all my heart, I'll say sorry. Just stop running away from me like some fool of a moody schoolchild.
But you didn't say anything to me. And you didn't do anything to me.
Well, that's what I was thinking, like.
I just don't like you no more.
You do like me.
I don't.
You liked me yesterday.
Oh, did I? Yeah.
I thought you did.
Staff writer Patrick Radden Keefe interviewed McDonagh at the New Yorker Festival.
So congratulations on the film. It's kind of a breakup movie.
So that's all it is for me. I mean, that's definitely the starting point of it, to be as truthful to the sadness, I suppose, of a horrible breakup, where you can kind of understand both sides in it. I think that was the balance that I think you're naturally on Colin Farrell's side, definitely to begin with, and even in the script writing stage. But the thing to get right was to see as much of the story from Brendan Gleeson's point of view too.
Did you? And was that what it was from the original conception then?
Yeah, there was an earlier version of it just a few years before where it went to a plotty kind of stupid shitty place, but I just wanted this to be sort of plotless in a way, just to have the unraveling of this breakup be what the whole story was about.
Did you write having worked with these two actors before in Bruges, I mean, a very, very different movie, and yet one in which their dynamic is everything in the way that it is here. Did you write this one with them in mind?
Oh, yeah, very much so. We've sort of been wanting to get together in the 14 years since we made that. It hasn't quite happened. Obviously, I worked with Colin again for Seven Psychopaths, but I'd stayed friends with both of them. We always see each other if we're in each other's countries, and they've remained great friends. So we always hoped that something like this would come about. I've been very lazy about it, and I'm
When you got around to it, you got around to it.
Yeah. The fear was because, you know, we all loved In Bruges, and we love how much people love In Bruges, when you're getting the team back together, you don't want to fuck up that that love. You know, you don't want to do something that's lesser. You know, you can do something, I hope we've done something that's stranger, but definitely something that isn't not as good.
Yeah. And there's also, I mean, there's an aspect, it seemed to me, there's a kind of fable quality to the story. And I want to talk about Ireland. So, I mean, because you're a Londoner, but grew up with Irish parents and spent time in Ireland during the summers when you're growing up.
Yeah.
And your parents live there now, right? Yeah. Not far from where the film was made. And,
yeah.
And so much of your work has taken place in Ireland. And yet in the plays, I think there's sometimes also this like slightly fable kind of fairy tale quality. And I guess I just wondered, is the place where these stories take, is it a real place? Or is it a kind of Ireland of the mind? I wonder about your relationship to...
I think it's a sort of theatrical Irish place. You know, this island doesn't actually exist, but obviously the Civil War was a real thing and did... It is a very interesting part of the backdrop, so that takes away a little bit from the fable quality. But I think if you set anything 100 years ago and lean into mysticism and banshees and folklore and all that stuff, it's going to have... some semblance of that kind of thing.
And do you ever feel? I mean, I hope you'll take this question in the right way, because I'm a New Yorker who wrote a book about Ireland myself. But do you ever feel like there's a trespass or there's a license that you're taking? Is that something you're totally untroubled by, or is it something that you're kind of mindful of at all?
I mean, untroubled by it until the Irish reviews come in. Then things get troubling. But no, I mean, it's like more than just summer holidays as a kid. It's like we grew up in London. All of the families around us were Irish. And so you'd hear Irish music blaring from each sides of our little area where we grew up. Mum and Dad were very proud to be Irish and, you know, encourage it in us almost too much. But we'd go for Christmases. Our grandparents were still alive in Sligo at that time. So as a child, it felt like we were half the year there and half the year in London. Obviously, my accent is very London, but London Irish is probably a good way to describe me. I don't have a British passport, which is probably a good move these days. I've only had an Irish one. But I've always sort of been anti-nationalist and anti-patriotic and all those things. So the whole Irish-English thing, I kind of find a bit boring these days.
Yeah. That makes one of us. I read somewhere that that it was kind of a breakthrough for you as a writer with plays initially, that you thought about the way in which your father and I think your uncle maybe spoke, that there was a sort of idiom that you stumbled upon, and in the way that, you know, I mean, I would imagine in the way that for Mamet or Pinter, they kind of discovered a register and an idiom that unlocked something.
Exactly. In fact, Pinter and Mamet were sort of the two big influences, and sort of too much of an influence, in fact, because all of the stuff I was attempting to write then was sort of English or American based and very much sort of ripoffs of, you know, The Birthday Party or American Buffalo to a degree. And it was only once I knew I wanted to have dialogue be more theatrical than it is in real life. And I thought those were the best two people around who were doing that. But it was when I tried to do that in a West of Ireland context that things did open up and allowed the dialogue and the characters even to be a bit more poetic and heightened than the everyday London kind of stuff that I was trying to do.
I wanted to ask you, because you've had this fascinating career where you started with plays and then moved into film and have continued to do both. But I went back and I started reading these interviews that you did early in your career, 25 mm-hmm. years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You suddenly burst onto the scene, this young guy in his 20s. You'd written 7 plays in less than a year and just came out of nowhere. And there were these amazing interviews where you would talk to people who were clearly filled with a kind of wonder and envy. And they would say, like, you know, you're the first person since Shakespeare to have 4 shows simultaneously in London. Like, how do you do it? And your reaction was always, theater's fine. What I really want to do is get into movies. And you could feel they were so kind of crestfallen. I feel terrible because I know Fintan O'Toole, but I have to quote you this. This is you and Fintan O'Toole in 1998. for Bomb magazine. You said, I would be unhappy if I wrote 90 good plays and didn't make a good film. But if I made one good film, if I made one brilliant film, one really, really good film, I'd be happy. One would be enough. And then you say, like, clearly you're
kind
of...
What an arrogant little dick.
No, what I love is that it's Fenton who's there and he's like, he's celebrating your you know, budding career as a playwright. Clearly there was something going on his face because you then say, you really love theater, maybe, to him. And Fenton says, I do.
Oh, sweet Fenton.
So here's what I...
And his love of theater.
Exactly, right? So here's what I wondered. Is I wonder a couple of things. I mean, one is when you sit down to write something, how do you know if it's a movie or a play?
If it's got four characters and it's set inside, it's a play. if it doesn't have any donkeys or dogs, cats, it could go
cats
either way.
Cats you can manage. Yeah. And you said to The Guardian recently that you may want to devote the remainder of your career chiefly to films.
Well, it's something weirdly I don't know if it's just because Brendan Gleeson's character is on my mind, but definitely during COVID one does, you know, think of time passing and how much time you've got left. And I've sort of discovered as years gone by that it takes as much time or longer to do a play, to get it on, you know, off West End in London to West End to off Broadway to here. That'll be like four years or so. Whereas, you know, we made this last year and it's out now. So to take care of a play from start to finish does, you know, take a similar amount of time. I do feel like, you know, the plays that we got good like 25 years ago, you can't see them. They're all gone, you know, forever. And there's a sadness to that, I feel. And as the years go on, I always, as much as I used to slide plays off, I do love them if they're done my way. If they're done in a certain way, you know, Pinter's way or early Mamet's way or whatever. But I'm not going to swear off plays because if I get a good play idea, I'll jump into it. But if I'm seriously thinking about if you've got 20 years, 30 years left, you know, a film every couple of years is going to last more than a play will.
How do you decide on the setting of your movies and how do you do the research?
For this one, certainly, My parents live just across the bay from the Aran Islands, and that whole area of the West, Connemara, up through Sligo and Mayo, and all the way down to Cork and Kerry, the whole West is. I sound like the Irish Tourist Board now too, but it is the most beautiful part of the country, I think, and I always wanted to set something there and capture the beauty of it with three billboards. Also, it was to, you know, try and capture almost an old American small town with like a street that's kind of both sides close together and, you know, one horse sort of town. So location is always, and obviously Bruges was Bruges was a character. I do like the locations to be characters in the movies as much as possible.
When you watched the film for the first time, did you find it sadder or more hopeful than you originally anticipated?
I think I was always trying to make it as sad as possible. Once it's finished, I don't think I've got enough distance to know where it lies right now. Maybe I'll ask people afterwards. Who actually, show of hands, who is going to be sad or hopeful? Who think it's a sad film? Oh shit!
Well, mission accomplished.
Any hope out there? Oh wow! Okay, so I guess it's a sad film. We're definitely not going to win the Oscar.
Thank you so much, Martin, for coming.
Thanks,
Thank you to all of you
Thanks,
for coming
everyone.
To the New Yorker Festival. Good night.
The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe. Speaking with director and screenwriter Martin McDonagh.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.